Welcome to the Being Curious Show. I'm Brian Mariani, founder of No Shift Own.
And I'm Kelly Wagner, publisher of Edge Magazine. Our show is about curiously connecting teachers and seekers on a wide range of topics in a safe space. Few topics will be off limits, and we have some amazing guests to share with you.
Our intention is that our conversations will spark your own curiosity to create a life that lights you up and inspires you to be kind, thoughtful, open-minded to yourself and others.
We are on AM 950, Sundays at 2 p.m. and all podcast platforms. So, Brian, what are you curious about today? Hey, everybody. It is the Being Curious show with Brian and Kelly from Edge Magazine. Brian, we have a good guest today, don't we?
I'm so excited because today we don't just have an extraordinary person. He's like our friend. It's like my best friend. I love this guy.
Absolutely. And we're live from Daryl's studio today. So, Brian, introduce him.
Let's do this. So our guest today is Daryl Bolacek, and he is a serial entrepreneur, someone who has had many successes, many failures, and I love that he bounces up and far beyond kind of what most people would expect to have success in their life. He's done it multiple times. I'm so excited for our community to really get into his story and hear about everything that he's done in his life. So, Daryl, what got you curious about starting your path in life?
Well, thanks for having me on. Thanks for being here in the studio, too. Makes it kind of fun to be in my own location. And so, thanks for having me.
It's a beautiful studio. Thanks.
I wish people could see. Go from the producer seat to kind of swivel around, and all of a sudden, you're an active guest.
Yeah. So, thanks for the introduction. I started out much like a lot of people do in Minnesota here, standard little family home in the suburbs, and kind of pretty standard childhood to start out at my childhood.
Yeah, you know, pretty standard. Let's start there.
Went to an elementary school in Shoreview, Minnesota, and in fourth grade, that's when it all started, was when my mom asked me to play in the band or to join the band. And she said, well, what instrument do you want to play? And I said, trumpet. And she basically says, wah, 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 trumpet, really? Why don't you play something cool like the drums? And I was like, oh, okay, drums. So that is where my musical career kind of started, was fourth grade. I decided I was going to play percussion. She bought me a little mallet bag and a drum pad or whatever, and you kind of start learning how to do the bells was the first thing you had to learn, like the glockenspiel, like a bell set. So you had to learn notes, and I excelled at it right away. But my focus was that I really wanted to play the snare drum, because that was the main instrument in the band, is the snare drum. That's like the lead stick, or, you know, the lead chair with a violin or in anything. The snare drum is like the lead instrument for percussion in those type of things. And I really wanted to do it, but to be able to play the snare drum, I had to learn the whole book of bells. So I immediately just blasted through it, and I wanted to be the first one on the snare drum, and I was. And that's kind of when I learned that this is my thing. I'm good at it.
Did you have a sense that even at that time that you were, I don't want to say better than other people, like in the school band or orchestra, but were you like, I'm pretty good at this. Like, I'm definitely way above average.
Well, if you make snare line.
Well, that's for high school.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. I jumped.
Yeah. No, I was just like, I was in fifth grade. So you join in fourth grade, and then fifth grade is your first season or whatever. So it was before.
Are you kind of the B squad fourth grade, just kind of like watching everybody or just learning the bells or.
The summer of fourth grade is when you join and you say you're going to, or for back then anyway.
Okay.
So then your fifth grade year is the first year that you're in band class. But yeah, I excelled at it right away. And it was from that moment on, it was bizarre that everyone always deemed me as the best drummer, even though I had never really even proved myself. But because I wanted to blast ahead of everyone and take that spot, through all of my high school, or, you know, middle school and high school time, I was always just known to be like the best drummer. Everyone talked about Daryl the drummer. Oh, he's the best drummer. And I always was like, why do people, I don't get it. Like, I didn't see it that way ever. Anyway.
Was that your first thing that you can remember where you were like, not only are people saying I'm really good at something, but I just love doing what I'm doing anyway.
Yeah.
I'd be doing this even if people didn't say that.
Yep. And then, you know, forming a band, the first like actual band I was in was ninth grade. I had been in jamming with kids in middle school and all that, but my first actual band was in ninth grade, and we played the talent show and just like blew everyone out of the water. We played Crazy Train. Ozzy Osbourne and we played one other song, but anyway, that kind of just lit the whole thing on fire, and we became like the high school band. And then I joined the drum line, and I wanted to play snare drum there because that's, you know, to be lead stick, you know. I never made it to lead stick.
Oh, you didn't?
Nope. I did make it to the snare line, though. But then my senior year, I would have been lead stick, but we had, like, this big political fallout in the drum line, and pretty much everyone quit. So I didn't play. I wasn't in the drum line in my senior year.
No.
Yeah. And I would have been the lead stick.
Does that mean that there was someone more talented than you? Or what?
It was very, the snare line and the marching band, in my opinion, was slightly political as well, because the likable, his brother already went through high school, they, you know, like, he's definitely, like, some people join the snare line like they're, I think there was even either freshmen or sophomores that were making the snare line, but they wanted me in the pit right away because I could play mallets. So
offense to anybody in the pit, and my brother-in-law for Eden Prairie was in the pit, but there's something about being on the field and being in the snare line. That's just a little, like, you're kind of the rock stars on the field.
Yep.
Like, just being honest.
Oh, totally. And I was disappointed, but at the same time, they said they needed somebody good that could read music and that could play mallet instruments.
They needed you.
Yes, they needed me. So, and actually I played timpani.
Did you play timpani too?
Yes. Okay. So, and actually I ended up going to college, for percussion performance. And that is where I was going to be a timpanist for or a snare drummer for a symphony. So for like the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra or something like that, that was what I was going to do. But then
I had friends that went, is it Lawrence University in Wisconsin?
Oh,
I had some friends that went there.
Okay.
I'm assuming that's like a big,
You know,
private school for that arena. But we can move on.
Yeah.
So, did you go to like a music college, like specific place, or did they just happen to have a program at the school?
I, yes and no. I went to St. Cloud State University to just kind of get my general education and all that. I didn't last long at that university.
Oh,
okay.
I didn't actually last very long at any university.
Now we're understanding the pause.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how long did you last?
I lasted like maybe 1 year max. No, not even. Like maybe one semester.
So you are living out the classic entrepreneur story.
Oh, I absolutely hated school. I was pushed to go to college. I didn't want to go to college. I was going to do something in music, but at the same time, I was like, I'm going to be in a symphony. Like, I'm not like a symphony style
dude. I was
going to
say,
dude,
that's not really your like
style. I know, when you said that, I was like imagining you in like a suit
with the gloves playing on drums, playing timpani in the tuxedo doing like that. Like, amazing and gifted people and like rock on. It's
well, and those guys tap out at around $100,000 a year. That's about all you can expect to ever make.
We're not gonna like knock making $100,000 a year, but still.
But as
so, but, yeah, but
as
that's
we're
a
going
good
to
point.
Let the rest unfold.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. So
no, so how like like, among knowing that you were a gifted musician and that kind of was a natural thing that you also loved doing, you mentioned like $100,000 being like, well, I'm not going to do a job that I'm going to tap out there. So like, when did you discover, oh, I want to play a big game and I want to make a lot of money and I want to, like, what was that?
So I went to St. Cloud State, dropped out or whatever. I just was like, yeah, nope. Then I went, and then I was like, well, I'll do a trade because I'm good with my hands and like making things. I like tool shops and welding and woodworking and all that stuff. And so I went to St. Paul TVI for machine tool die technology to be a machinist. 9/11 happened while I was in class, and I was already feeling like the, oh, they're just training me how to do CNC, which is computer, is like, these machines are run by computers. They're not run by knobs and dials anymore. And I was like, this is not what I thought. I don't want to program a computer to do what I thought I was going to be doing with my hands. So these lathes and mills, they're all being run with CNC. 9/11 happens, and I just walk out the door. I never came back. He's like, you guys can go home. We're under attack. And so we all left, and I never came back. So that was the end of the trade school. Made it through about a year of that. I moved in with my mom to save some money or whatever. And she said, the only way you're staying here is if you're going to go to college. So she's like, pick something and do it. I remember her, literally those were her words, pick something and then do it and follow through. I found, so I was like, okay, well, I've tried the music thing, that this doesn't seem like I need to go to college for music. I already know how to play my instrument, blah, blah, blah. I looked into, it was called Music Tech at the time. And then it became McNally Smith College of Music, and they had a program called Music Business. They had a music business degree, and I was like, boom, music business. That's what I'm going to do. And that's when I kind of decided I'm going to try to tackle the business side of the industry of music. And that's, so I went there and I actually did complete it.
And as a serial entrepreneur that you are, you're infusing that music and that business together. So I could see you in the classes going, oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yep.
And having those light bulbs go off.
Yep.
What was your first idea? Like, what was your first thing? Like, okay, here's the music business I'm going to create. Like, what was that?
So I, this might have been before I went to this. So my timeline might be a little messed up. I believe that my first business idea was before I went to college for music business. And that was, it was called, I had this grandiose idea and I did do it, but it was called Messages Music Marketing.
MMM. Messages Music Marketing.
Yes. And what my plan was to have a comprehensive, awesome little digital package where I'd record on hold music for companies' telephone systems. It was just an idea that I had. I was like, well, I can do that. So that's when I kind of started recording too. So that's a very beginning stages of me becoming an audio engineer, was probably about the year 2000-ish.
And was that inspired because you didn't like the on-hold music that was available? Or like, why did you come up with that?
I just I had a job in the telecom running low-voltage wires. And I remember thinking, like, well, I'm already at these places that are setting up these big phone networks with Cat5 cables, you know. And I thought, well, it's such an easy thing. I'll just record, you know. Thank you for being on hold. Well, you're on hold, or you know, and you can. And then my idea was that you would have an advertisement on it, because a lot of times it's like, thank you for being on hold. Somebody will be with you shortly. I thought, well, why not have, why not peddle your product?
Like companies could purchase 5 or 15 or 10 second ads.
Yep. And then you formulate a relationship with that customer, and the holidays are coming. Let's change the on hold music to reference some new product that they're, or the holiday. So that was that idea, and it didn't go anywhere.
But did anyone ever pay you for that?
No, I was in the very beginning stages of just trying to figure out how to do it. So I was starting to record, bought a laptop, and that's the beginning of me starting to actually learn the whole recording, audio recording stuff.
Okay, so we've got first business idea in the bag, and we got to go to break. But I think we're going to dive into some more ideas around music. You also were in a band. So we'll be right back. This is the Being Curious show with Brian and Kelly. We are on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We'll be right back.
Hello, hello. We are back. It is Being Curious with Brian and Kelly, AM 950, the progressive radio of Minnesota. Today we are here with, how to describe Daryl in just a couple words? I don't know. I can't.
I mean, we've gotten pretty far into your story already. So you just had your first business idea. You didn't necessarily execute on it, but was there something that happened in the music world that kind of took you in a different direction, or what happened next?
If I had the timing right, the next thing that I did was end up going to music college for music business at McNally Smith College of Music. During that time, my last semester there, I studied abroad. They actually opened an arm of the school in Lübeck, Germany. So I moved out there I lived out there for 6 months and finished that internet. I was doing like international music business stuff and played on the street. So I found the cajon. Before the cajon was like a thing that everybody had to have. Now, if you guys don't know what one is, if I showed it to you, you'll know. A cajon means big box in Spanish. But big box. My buddy played guitar. I wanted to play drums. I found the cajon. I bought one at the store there. And we would go on what was called the Breitestrasse, which was like this like market street. And we would sit out there and just jam out for hours and hours and hours. And we would make like over 100 euro. Every time we did it. So like that was enough money for beer and hanging out at the bars and just doing whatever we wanted to do. So we did more of that than actually going to school. The school was kind of a joke. We were the ones setting up the computers, like like everything was brand new there. So we had to bring in, chairs and tables and like, there wasn't really much schooling going on. You know, we were kind of just like workhorses for the school to get the school set up. So 90% of our time was just exploring Lübeck, Germany and playing music on the streets. And we did that. And so we formed a band, and that was my first kind of formal band after, towards the end of my college stuff. And that was, we called ourselves the Dooners. We named ourselves after a sandwich that we ate every day. A Dooner kebab.
Ah,
a Dooner kebab.
Dooner.
Yeah.
Dooner kebab.
Yeah.
But you called it Dooner.
That's what they're. That's how.
Oh,
they
that's what they pronounced it.
Yeah. So it was a Dooner kebab, is what they. That we would eat them every day.
Yeah.
And we would eat Schinken Knockers, which is just translates in English to ham cracker.
Right.
And it's basically ham, just like a natural cased sausage that would, you know, like crack, like snap into a Slim Jim. Anyway, so we started the Dooners, and it was. The Dooners, check them out. That was our slogan. So we had a little branding thing going on.
Sure.
And we play a lot. So we ended up coming back to the...
And you should have saw yourself how you became animated and like went back to that, like, the Dooners, check them out. So you start to play.
Yeah. So
please tell me that the album art on your first CD was a Dooner.
It wasn't.
What was it?
A picture that I took on a train that we were going 140 miles an hour on this train, and I took a picture out the window, and that's what ended up being the cover.
Oh, how artsy of you.
Yeah. It's just a
smear. What was the name of your first CD album?
No One Likes to Be Lonely.
Okay.
Heavy.
Yeah. So we get back here, and this was kind of my first music business, was going to be just kind of promoting this band and getting shows and basically doing the thing, and that's exactly what I did. So we played probably 2 or 3 times a week and did that for a few years, and that's when I met Jason Shannon, who I ended up, I wanted to be in more of a full-size band. And I really wanted to make more money because I was trying to do it as a career. The Dooners, we were just too small of a group. It was good stuff. It was fun, but it was just, we weren't making a ton of money. So I ended up joining Jason Shannon. And so we formed an actual legit full-on band. We had horns, we had violin, keys. So yeah, we had keyboard. Wow. Yeah, we had like a 5-piece full-on band. And we turned it into a business, and we practiced religiously. We had our own studio, much like this, kind of tricked out, probably about half the size. And it was just a practice studio, and that was Jason's. And we'd show up just like a job. I'd show up, and we'd practice and write songs.
So you were a professional musician.
Yep. Yep.
And did the business side of it as well.
Yes.
And were you really in charge of the business side? Was that your baby?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And that, and I had, at that point, I had gotten, I'm not sure if I had gotten married yet or not, but I was with my ex-wife at the time, and we started an LLC called D&M Music Marketing. So that was the LLC that managed the band's like business.
And so your business owned the band,
basically. Yeah. Yep. So
was that given, like, did you just kind of come in and you go, we're going to make the band and I'm going to just run this show. You guys just show up and be the band.
Or did you guys kind of like all like a Trivial Pursuit piece, game piece, say, I'll take this, you take this, you take this, you take this.
I don't exactly know, except for I was probably the only one that like stepped forward and said, hey, we need to start an LLC and like make this legit. And then I would just became the dude right then. I'm pretty sure that's how it happened. Okay. No musician's interested in LLCs.
No.
Well, that's what I'm kind of getting at, this very unique part of you that just is always thinking, oh, we're going to like, we're not just going to do this. Like, we're going to make a business, and I somehow know how to do that.
Yeah. Like
I don't think a lot of people's brains work that way.
No.
you said, okay, we're going to, clearly I'm good at something, and now I'm going to up level that, and I'm not just going to create a band. It's like, we're going to do this professionally, and we're going to have a studio. We're going to show up every day. I'm going to create a business.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that the bandmates were like-minded and they were probably really happy that you were doing that, but they were as committed in their own craft and their own contribution to the band.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yep. And part of the development of the business of the band was to find a manager that would get us shows, bigger shows. And that's, I don't know if you guys have ever heard the name in town here, Micah McFarlane, or he has a McFarlane brother that's kind of a well-known guy. But anyway, we had some money sitting around, and we hired him, and we're like, get us on a tour. We're ready. I bought a big Class C motorhome with the big, you know, the little thing you can sleep in above it, you know, that goes over the cab over thing.
Just one quick second before. You said you had some money lying around. Was that because you were making money playing, or just guys in the band together pooled funds together?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I don't remember exactly. I think it didn't cost a ton of money to get him on board. I think it cost, we just had to make money to pay him 20% of whatever we're making. Because typically a manager for a band is going to make 20%, roughly, give or take, is going to make 20% of any money coming in. So we just needed a little boost to, like, I guess, retain him or whatever.
So you have the manager, you have the motorhome, you're practicing.
Yes, and then the big step was we needed $11,000 to get on a national tour.
Why do you have to pay to get on a national tour?
pay to play type of deal.
Got it. Okay.
Yep. Basically, how that goes business wise is that you have to pay for a spot on their bus. They usually have these big. It's pronounced Prevost, but a lot of people think it's Prevost. But these big million-dollar buses you see on tours.
Yeah.
You can be a supporting act, but they're gonna charge you to be on that bus. So instead of. But see, it really wasn't about that because we had our own.
I was about to say you had your own motorhome.
We had our own motorhome and our own place for. We are all completely self-sufficient. We had our own trailer with all of our gear, everything. It was still. It didn't matter. It was. That's you just had to pay to be on the tour with them. And it makes sense because they're bringing you out in front of their crowd that they spent their career developing,
right?
And you get to sell your merchandise to them. They weren't taking any profit of the merchandise, so we could sell CDs and T-shirts at every show, and that was just pure profit. That was just our money.
So outside, your manager gets 20%. Everything else was yours.
Yep,
which is really really lovely.
Yep. But I needed $11,000 to get on the tour. Once we had that money, we're on a bus or on our RV and we got on the tour. And then we were able to sustain our livelihood for 2 years by selling merchandise and playing the shows. So we weren't getting paid to play at the show. We were strictly making money off of selling merchandise.
Got it.
So
did you design the shirts or did you pay people to do all that? Or were you very much involved in that process?
My ex-wife was the tour manager, so she.
Oh, and then she's got it sells out, and you got to make sure you have the different sizes and the different colors, and then you have to make sure it's shipped to that next spot, and oh my gosh.
Yep. So we kind of had the full thing. We had a manager, we had a tour manager, and then the business manager. So I was the business manager, ex-wife, tour manager, and then we had the band manager who was getting us on shows. So we did that for 2 years, and that's where I was telling you guys earlier about how I poked my head through the clouds of stardom or whatever, and because we were playing some pretty big shows with a lot of people, and it just wasn't necessarily what it was all cracked up to be.
What were some of the most surprising things that is just known in the industry that the people that I'm seeing the Behind the Music series. Was that VH1 or MTV? No, I think it was VH1, but Behind the Music. What are some things that just people would never guess that are just normal that everyone just knows in the industry that our fantastic community would love to hear? I took a long way getting there on that question. I apologize.
That's okay.
Right?
Well, I guess people don't realize how much work it is. Was your question more of the feeling of playing in front of people or the...
Did no, you the have behind fans? The scenes stuff.
The behind the scenes stuff. The behind the scenes stuff was just basically a ton of work. And as soon as you're done playing and giving all this energy to a huge crowd of people, which takes a lot of energy to give that much energy. And as a drummer, of course, yeah. I'm physically... you get on your bus and you have to drive 500 miles to the next show. And then you sleep, you wake up, and then you're loading all this gear in and you're setting up all your equipment. And then you're mingling and talking with people. So that takes a ton of energy just to be able to communicate and meet people and share, your good energy.
So I'm assuming meet and greets and just
yep.
So you're on.
Yep. And then you play the show and then you load all your stuff back in its cases, load it into a trailer and then drive another 500 miles, sometimes 1,000 miles. Sometimes you gotta go from California over to Dallas.
You described that moment where you could have been a star. What made you notice I'm right there? Was it the amount of fans you had? Was it the money you were making? Was it recognition?
I the amount of people that were at the shows was way above and beyond what most people can do when they're a musician. To having 5,000 people cheering at you, I mean, that's a small show. Obviously, stadium shows and big name bands, they'll put 50,000 people in a stadium. We're not at that level, but we're at a as far as you could ever dream of being when it comes to people actually there to watch you. They're there to watch the main act too, but it was a show that was promoted as two acts.
So who was the main show?
Bob Schneider.
What kind of music was he doing?
It's like, you know, like Jason Mraz, like singer-songwriter stuff. John Mayer.
Well, and you're living off the merchandising, so when you're out, you're playing, you're on stage, and you see people wearing your stuff, what was that like?
That's funny, because this was like pushing 15, maybe almost 20 years ago. Well, no, 15 years ago, and I still see people wearing the shirts, because we bought American Apparel shirts, and they're really nice, and they seem to last forever. So, like, my sister and my brother-in-law, like, I always see them posting pictures on Facebook, and they're always wearing a Jason Shannon shirt, because they're just nice shirts. But and then I see other people, I run into it, because we sold a lot of shirts, and we sold thousands of them. So, they're out there, and they're probably still good to go.
They could be on eBay, you know.
Yes.
Speaking of good to go, we got to go to commercial break. We're having so much fun with Daryl. I know that there's more to come. I know you've built other businesses. So we will be right back. This is Being Curious. We are on AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. We'll be right back.
Are back, Being Curious with Brian and Kelly, AM 950. Today we're here with Daryl. This is our third segment with him. Super exciting. Talking about music, talking about time on the road.
Daryl's almost a celebrity.
Daryl's almost a celebrity. So what's next in the life? Like, so you're on tour, you guys are learning a lot, getting to that area. What ends it? What makes you go like, okay, this just isn't what it's cracked up to be, and it's time to close this book and do something else?
Yes. So the whole pay to play idea was very obvious. So we knew that it was to hop on more tours, we would have to have more big chunks of money to throw at it, which is really tough to do. And so we did a two-year run on that tour, and we ended up wanting to try our own tour. So we booked our own tour and booked all the venues and everything and set sail on our own. And we immediately realized how much more work we had to do. And it was extremely daunting. Like,
so you're like, pay the $11,000 or do it ourselves. And that $11,000 check really wasn't as painful as you thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. But.
So what do you learn from that? So like.
Well, what rate are you at now? You started at $11,000, but to be a celebrity, what was the check at that point?
It would totally just depend on the tour. Maybe you get on a tour. Maybe they really like you and you would help bring people to their venue and they just let you do it for free. It totally would be per case basis, or, you know, per tour. And the tour manager, the manager of that band would be like, oh, yeah, just you guys can open for us. Or, yeah, we don't even know who you are and you're going to have to give us however much money.
So what happens? So you kind of alluded that you decided not to go big and continue with the band.
Yeah.
So what was that next decision? What was the next business? What was the next idea? What happened?
So we tried the tour on our own. It didn't work. We called it quits halfway through. We all got kind of homesick. Some of the shows were, well, the shows that were bad, where like there wasn't many the turnout was really bad, were depressing. And it, you know, and we're like, well, is the next one going to be like this? Because if it is, I don't want to do it.
Now, did you have an opening band underneath you guys?
No.
Or it was just you guys?
Yeah, we were just playing in much smaller venues. But anyway, so we ended up coming home, and what exactly was the next step here? Well, I think everybody just kind of settled down, and I ended up getting married. Yeah.
I kind of get that it was either keep doing what you're doing and almost like get investors to help you pop it up, or come home, we're fried.
Yep.
And everyone, it was awesome. But it might be time for everyone to kind of move on to something else.
Yeah, that's basically what boiled down
to. That's just the vibe I get, and yep. I mean, no, I don't think you have to be psychic to do that.
I was having a hard time putting it to words.
But I just kind of went into your head and kind of grabbed it for you.
Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, the next few years are just kind of being newly married. So fast forward a few years. The next business I got into was a commercial brewery, and that was spawned off of the end of my first marriage, of the necessity to just be free and get something done and do something cool, change my life.
Maybe put some roots down.
Yes, definitely. I had just built a house.
Right.
So I was, I had a spot to put the brewery, and that project was the ultimate in entrepreneurial startup, business startup, and borrowing. So just like you see, like on Shark Tank, like we took it as far as that, where we even drove with our beer to an investor's house with a huge keg tap, like serving station in the bed of my truck with like, I think we had like 6 taps or more. We had like 12 taps. But anyway, so I just jumped way ahead. I learned to borrow money, write a business plan, borrow money, and then implement the starting of the business.
Right.
And that was huge. I ended up borrowing $1 million to buy all the equipment we needed.
And what's it, I'm sorry to interrupt, but like, what's it like to have someone believe in you so much that they're like, we will loan you $1 million. Like,
yeah. What did you have to show them for them to do
I had
that?
To show them ambition, and I had to show them the beer. They had to drink the beer. They wanted to make sure. So, but I had very well covered every base before I got to the point of asking for money. I sent my business partner to England to school to learn how to brew beer better than anyone's brewing beer in our area here. So that was the idea. Like, if we're going to do this, we need to have the best beer. So before we even asked for money or anything, I invested my time and money into my business partner and sent him to Europe to learn old world brewing techniques that were going to be tried and true for thousands of years. So he came back. I bought a test batch system with a credit card, and this big test batch system is where we were going to develop our recipes. So we literally, he gets back. And
did you have an idea of like, this is what I want my bestseller beer to be, or this is what I want to be known for? Or did you discover it when you just started brewing?
We knew that we just needed a good pale ale, you know, a good IPA, a good pale ale. Well, but we had a whole line of beers, but, yeah, I think the best selling beer is some type of light ale. You know, we weren't going to be making Coors Light or anything like that. It was definitely craft beer. But
and so other than the executive decision to, you know, send your partner to learn the best craft, what else did you discover? Like, this is why we're going to stand out in the beer marketplace. Like, what was it? How you looked?
Yep. Like, marketing.
Yeah.
Yep. So we did pretty extensive marketing when it came to branding. We ended up naming the company Cosmos, just Cosmos Brewing Company. And our whole entire theme was outer space, beer, like just space.
What was your tagline?
Save space for beer. Cosmos Brewing Company, save space for beer.
Save space for beer. Now, did you come up with that, or how did that?
Actually, my business partner came up with that one. I'll give him that. That's
pretty good line.
Yep. Safe space for beer. It was on my truck. It was on our trucks. It was, yeah, that was our thing. But we also had a little alien mascot who was holding up a mug, and his shirt says, "Is take me to your leader." LITER.
That's fantastic.
We had a lot of thought. The marketing was really the funnest part of the work that we had to do. Brewing beer was a lot of hard work,
right?
But the marketing was just fun because we got to just sit around and collaborate on ideas. And designing beer cans, we would have an idea, and then we had a full-time graphic designer. Well, I shouldn't say full-time graphic designer. We had a graphic designer that did all of the artwork, and it was all custom artwork with our ideas. So we'd be like, we need, we had a beer called the Martian Rambler, and it was like a old Rambler, car from the 80s.
Wow.
And, the aliens driving it with this beer out the window. As the kind of the CEO of the company, I had some issues with we're going to have somebody holding a beer out the window of a car? On a can of beer.
Like, you had to process that thought.
Yeah, and I sent it to the state to get my label, and they approved it. And I was like, they just approved a beer with an alien driving a car holding a mug of beer out the window.
Be interesting to find out what the meeting was like that when they were going through that, or it was someone just on a really bad day. They're like, approve. We'll just do it. So, I doubt it was that easy.
Yeah.
How far did you get with this business? Like, did it launch? Did you have a restaurant attached to the brewery?
So we were distributing only. We were a beer manufacturer distributing beer. We didn't have a tap room. So we were wholesaling beer to bars and restaurants and liquor. Well, and then we ended up canning beer too. We ended up renting a canning machine that would come in once a week and can all of our beer. And that's when we started selling to liquor stores.
So your beer was in stores and at bars?
Yes. Yep.
Wow.
Yep. We were slowly taking over, taps. Like, it's a battle for tap lines at bars. Right. So we were doing pretty good. I think the first season of business, I think we were selling about 20 grand worth of beer per week or so, something like that. It was a decent amount of beer. We were selling a lot of beer.
20
so
grand
I had to
a
buy
week.
A van to be able to put the because we had to distribute it ourselves. We didn't. So what you're doing at this point is you're trying to build your business enough revenue and enough clout and whatever to be able to go to a distributor and say, will you distribute our beer for us?
Right.
And I was in negotiations and talking with that, and I got real close to having that happen. But since entrepreneurship is about successes and failures, this is one that technically failed. But
led you to today. Like, let's talk, and in the time we have left on this, it brought you to your musical passion.
Yes.
It brought you to... So you had to have that, and I don't want to call it a failure. Let's just call it a learning. There was outside circumstances.
Yes.
It wasn't just like you were doing really, really well, and there was outside circumstances that closed that door.
Yes.
So now you're in this beautiful studio that recording. You get to use your passion. We are surrounded by musical instruments and drum sets and all of this love. I mean, all of this equipment that's been loved by Daryl. And you have a recording studio. You specialize in audiobooks. Craft with love. Well, yeah.
Yeah. How did you
bridge
that gap? We're here.
Yeah.
You have a thriving brewery, but that didn't work out for whatever reason. How do you get from there to this insanely awesome studio? You're producing audiobooks.
Something similar. So the brewery was awesome and it was becoming successful, and then circumstances just pushed it and I had to sell the whole property and everything. But the necessity to have something more simple, I was like, I want a simple business. I don't want employees, because the employees with the brewery, I was just like, oh my gosh, this is horrible. I didn't want to deal with other people like that. Plus the taxes, and then just being an employer is like not the greatest place to be. But I learned a lot from it, and someday I hope to build this business to have employees. But I lost my train of thought.
It's okay.
How did you start the audiobook business or the studio?
Yeah, so out of necessity for it, I wanted a smaller business. I was already basically a part-time audio producer, producing music and recording for artists. because on the side of the brewery, I started Wild Horse Recording. So I Wild Horse Recording was already an LLC before the brewery. So it was just like a side gig. And I wanted to take the studio and actually make money with it and actually start a career and give it everything. So another 2 feet in the boat, push off the dock type of venture. And audiobooks is the driving force of the income for the studio. Instead of trying to squeeze blood out of turnips like I have done with musicians my whole life, audiobooks is a whole different market, but that whole different market still can end up in a studio, which is recording audiobooks.
And why would an author or publisher or publicist want to work with Wild Horse?
Because they get their, they don't just get an audiobook, they get to get me.
Yeah.
Because I love the creative process of anyone who's being creative. I don't care what it is. If you're being creative, I'm drawn to it. So I'm naturally drawn to people's creative writing and their stories, and the books they've written have taken them typically like years to pull off. So I love just being on with the author and creating a good representation of their manuscript onto an audiobook. So the creative process is very fun for them.
Well, and 50% of books now sold are audiobooks, correct? I mean, that's also, there's a need. There's a market there for it.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So how do people get a hold of you?
Wildhorserecording.com.
Perfect.
And my phone number, I think, is on the website because it's a pretty niche little thing. So.
And you have like a form. So if you're an author, if you're a publisher, publicist, and you need another studio that's awesome, crafted with love, go to your website, check it out.
Yep. And we do full production and post-production. So if you've already recorded your audiobook, we can take all the files and create the post-production audiobook for you as well.
Bottom line, get curious, be curious with Daryl at Wild Horse Recording. Daryl, I love the full circle that we had today. We are being curious with Brian and Kelly, AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Bye for now.